Airstrikes averted today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. The president called off airstrikes on Iran with 10 minutes to spare.
We've known for a long time that President Trump is reluctant to enter into a new military entanglement in the Middle East.
We ask what the chain of events tells us about the White House.
Decisions are being made about the security of the United States of America on the basis of the gut instinct of the President of the United States without adequate information.
The latest on Iran this hour, plus two sisters shake up gondola building in Venice with some advice from their father.
My father say always that for make this kind of job, you need a lot of soramanego. It's a Venetian word that means know-how.
Those stories ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. It's sobering to think how close we came to having an active military confrontation with Iran last night, a matter of minutes, according to President Trump. He tweeted today to confirm that he'd authorized airstrikes against three Iranian targets in retaliation for Iran shooting down a U.S. drone, only to call them off with just 10 minutes to spare. The reason? Trump said he was told that 150 people would lose their lives if the mission was completed. He decided that would not have been a proportionate response to the loss of one unmanned U.S. drone. There's been a wide range of responses to this. Ambassador Nicholas Burns is supportive of the president's decision. Burns was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs under President George W. Bush. He also advised Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016.
This is a tough job to be president, especially when you order young men and young women into battle. There's a lot riding on correct decision-making. I frankly am not willing to be critical if, in fact, the president pulled back because he had doubts about the mission. I think as long as we send the right message to the Iranians, diplomatically or militarily, we're doing what the United States has to do.
But there's also plenty of criticism. Wendy Sherman was President Obama's Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. She also helped negotiate the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran that's at the root of the tensions now between Washington and Tehran. Ambassador Sherman, what happened last night?
That is a really good question. It is quite extraordinary to imagine that the President of the United States had not been briefed that there would be 150 casualties, people killed with this strike that was underway. It shows that there is not a regular policy process, there is not a regular briefing process, that decisions are being made about the security of the United States of America on the basis of the gut instinct of the President of the United States without adequate information, purpose, a definition of what our interests are, and a strategy to achieve them.
Can you think of any precedent for what happened last night?
Off the top of my head, no. You know, some people have begun to describe what is going on to Barbara Tuchman's famous book, The Guns of August, about how World War One happened through a series of escalatory steps. Now, the context is not the same. The situation is not the same. But the sense that sort of out of happenstance and disregard for understanding the broader dynamics at play, we found ourselves at World War One. Those dynamics are at play here because it seems that there is no regular order. There is no real definition of what U.S. interests are in this instance. There is no consultation with allies. There is not a strategy, and there is not a process for executing that strategy.
You've been in rooms where big decisions like this are made. What's that like?
Well, that's what's so amazing here. I find it very hard to believe that no one had briefed the president as part of the process of what would be undertaken, what assets would be used, what the risks were, what the casualties would be, what the potential reaction of Iran would be, that all of those pieces had not been put on the table. Because usually there is a very detailed process in terms of Pentagon planning, intelligence reports, decision memos, National Security Council meeting with the president to go through all of the elements and have a very decisive process. I think anybody who has watched episodes of The West Wing has seen time and time again where the fictional President Bartlet goes to the Situation Room, and probably the first question he asks around decisions like this is, will anyone be killed?
Because of Trump's turnaround last night, does that mean this war scare is over, or could it return?
Oh, I think it absolutely can return. I think that the president will, I assume, regroup with someone today. Iran will have a reaction. There was, as you know, a Reuters story that the president sent communication to Iran through Oman saying we're about to imminently attack, but I won't do it if you agree to talks. I don't know what the timing or sequence was of that letter, but, you know, I appreciate the president actually wanted to do some diplomacy since this has been coercive diplomacy that's been all coercion and no diplomacy, but it was obviously very ineptly done.
What's the bigger picture in terms of how this impacts U.S. prestige and influence abroad?
I think it's quite disastrous. It looks like the White House doesn't know what it's doing. It has no process. It has no consultations. It has no clear sense of purpose and objective. I think there are very big questions that have not been asked and answered as the president considers what he's doing here. And he has said that he doesn't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. Well, the best way to have ensured that was to stay in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, hoped that you might get underway a follow-on agreement, that you would have had a channel of communication to deal with Iran's malign behavior in the region, its human rights abuses, Americans held in prison in Iran. But instead, the president blew that up. He's allowed his advisors to constrain his choices so that he really has almost nowhere to go and looks like and appears to be flailing around.
And, of course, you were a key negotiator on the JCPOA. Final question is there even a slight chance that the fact that Trump changed his mind, seemingly over a humanitarian concern, could that be a message to Iran that, okay, we can deal with these people, we can deal with Trump?
Well, I think that's the hopeful impression we would all hope for. But I think that Iran will also see this as a president who's not quite sure what he's doing, who does not follow through, undermines his own credibility, and probably further deepens the concern about how to proceed here. I think what we really need here is a normal order of business for the president and his advisors to really think through what are Americans' national security interests, to consult deeply with our allies and partners, to put a strategy together, and then exquisitely implement that strategy. None of that appears to have occurred here.
Wendy Sherman is the former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We'll have more reaction to President Trump's handling of the Iran crisis later in the show. For now, let's just take a moment to remember how we got here. And for that, you have to go back to 2015, when President Obama made this announcement.
The United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not. A comprehensive, long-term deal with Iran that will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
That was 4 years ago. President Trump disliked the deal way before he got into office, arguing that it didn't go far enough to contain Iran's nuclear ambitions. A year ago, he pulled the U.S. out of the agreement, setting the stage for a more difficult chapter in the Iran-U.S. relationship.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
The Islamic Republic's Revolutionary Guard Corps has actively engaged in terrorism and created, supported, and directed other terrorist groups.
A year on from the U.S. withdrawal from a landmark nuclear deal with Iran, Tehran now says that it will resume high-level enrichment of uranium if the remaining signatory countries do not keep their promises under the agreement.
The U.S. is sending 1,000 additional troops to the Middle East amid these rising tensions with Iran. And tonight, the new threat from Iran.
We have breaking news from the Middle East at this hour. Iran says that it shot down an American drone flying over its territory, raising fears that a larger military conflict could break out in the region.
President Trump approved military strikes on a number of Iranian targets, what's called a measured response after an American drone was shot down. Planes were in the air, ships in position, when suddenly, according to the Times, the order came to stand down.
As I mentioned earlier, President Trump confirmed today that he did call off the airstrike with just 10 minutes to spare when he learned it would kill 150 Iranians. Trump said the airstrike would not have been a proportionate response to Iran's shooting down an unmanned U.S. drone. There's rain in the forecast for the next few days in Chennai, India. That should be good news for the city's 4.5 million residents, because Chennai has just endured a long period of drought, and there's a huge water crisis there. Many residents simply don't have enough to drink or bathe, or in some cases, to use the toilet. The BBC's Pramila Krishnan has been covering the story. Pramila, are the rains enough to help?
Actually, the first spill of rain was just a slight rain. Though the Met Office has predicted good rain for the next 2-3 days, as of now, the signs are not that good.
So there's rain forecast for Chennai, but it's not nearly enough to really help with this water shortage.
Yeah, people are keeping their fingers crossed, and in many temples, they are praying God for rains.
And what's behind the water shortage? What's been causing it?
Chennai city is the coastal city, but it has few water body connections, and there is a huge deficit of monsoon water.
So it's been a long hot spell, and the reservoirs which Chennai relies on for its water supply, they're just drying up?
Yes. And also many wetlands have been encroached. The educational institutions, big roads, private apartments, many companies have come up. And in many places, the city is expanding in an unplanned manner.
When's the last time there was any serious rain in Chennai?
Actually, in 2015, Chennai faced a severe floods. So this shows there is a problem in saving water, storing them and using it properly.
How is the government dealing with the drought?
Actually, only today, the chief minister of this particular state has accepted that there is a water crisis. The chief minister of this particular state and the water supply minister, they were claiming that there is no such water shortage, and this is a news manufactured by media. But as of now, the government has allotted some money for reclaiming the water bodies which were encroached. But the pace in which the reclaiming of water bodies has to pick up in a big manner.
How are people reacting in Chennai?
People are very angry. They are really angry. You can see a lot of people on the streets waiting for water. And when media people talk to them, many of them are really angry. And some of them are reluctant to talk because they say they would not get water if they are seen on media.
The BBC's Pramila Krishnan talking to us about the severe water shortage in Chennai, India. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Two sisters challenge the male-dominated gondola industry in Venice. That story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's a rest day today at the Women's World Cup soccer tournament in France. The group stage wrapped up yesterday. 8 teams were eliminated. And tomorrow we move on to the first knockout stage, the round of 16. So it's win or go home from here on in. The World's William Troop is always on the soccer beat for us. William, quick recap. What are the surprises at this point?
Well, all of the teams that were ranked in the top 10 in the world, they all went through to the next phase of the World Cup. The only surprise that I see is that in Group C, which included Brazil and Australia, both very highly rated teams, the team that came up on top was Italy, which is ranked much lower. They have been playing above their rank. And the other surprise is that for the first time ever, 2 teams from Africa are going to make it to the round of 16, Cameroon and Nigeria. That's never happened before at a Women's World Cup. So it's a sign that the quality of soccer in various parts of the world is improving.
So what are the major talking points so far?
You might have heard the first one about the 13 goals that the U.S. scored against Thailand, and the controversy over whether some of the American players celebrated some of those goals a little excessively. But the other big talking point has been the VAR, the video assisted referee.
How does it work?
A team of referees is looking at the video feeds of the various cameras that are following the game. And the idea is that if they see a glaring mistake made by the referee on the field, they will alert the referee that they need to watch the video review. In this tournament, the most controversial part of this has been that penalty saves are being scrutinized much more closely than ever before, and more of this is happening.
Getting ready to retake the penalty, and this time she scores! Argentina have pulled it back!
Like you heard right there, for Argentina, they get a chance to kick the ball again for the penalty, and a lot of the times, it's a goal as opposed to a save.
So it's like a whole other layer of refereeing.
It's a whole another layer of refereeing, a whole other new thing for fans to argue about.
Okay, so big question. Do you think the U.S. will defend its World Cup title?
On the one hand, it looks pretty good. Their next round of 16 matchup is with Spain, which is not ranked very high. So on paper, the U.S. should have an easy time. But things are going to get hard fast after that. The U.S. did beat a top 10 team in its last group stage game, Sweden, 2-0. But as you'll hear right now, U.S. captain Carolee Lloyd admitted afterwards that it was a difficult game.
We knew that it was obviously going to be a tough, challenging game against Sweden, physical. But we did some really good things. I think there's still some things that we can, you know, all improve on. But that's the beauty of kind of growing within a tournament. You know, you peak at the end when it matters. And, that's what we want.
I agree with Lloyd that one of the key aspects for the U.S. team is going to be to not get too confident too early as they progress, because the Americans are going to need to stay really focused if they want to make it all the way to the final.
Talking soccer and Women's World Cup with the world's William Troop. Thanks a lot, William.
You're welcome, Carol.
Venice is a city that runs on ancient unwritten rules, including this one. Gondolas are made and steered by men. But two young women are challenging that tradition. The Tramontine sisters inherited their father's gondola-making workshop after he died last year, and they're determined to keep the family business going. The BBC's James Reynolds visited them at their workshop in Venice.
Ciao. Look at this yard. Goodness me. This is the gondola they're building. You can smell the black paint. È pronto? Questo? It's nearly ready.
I'm Elisabetta, I'm 29.
I'm Elena Tramontine, I'm 31, and we are the first woman to run a gondola maker business in Venice. Our place at the Colored Square was founded by my great-great-great-grandfather, Domenico, and he was important because he's made a revolution in the shape of the gondola. And after there was my great-great-grandfather, Giovanni. After there was my grandfather, Nedis. At the end was my father, Roberto.
When you were both growing up, did you know that you were going to do this professionally?
No. We never think about after our dad. When it happened that my father has passed away, we decide to continue. So we are here for this reason. My father say always that for make this kind of job, you need a lot of soramanego. It's a Venetian word that means know-how. You need a know-how and you need to love what you do. Every gondola is unique. It's a piece of art for only one gondola.
The Tramontine family has been making gondolas for 134 years. And there's a coat of arms outside their battered workshop. And the sign itself may need replacing. It says Tramontine and Sons. But of course, the company is now run by daughters. You're women and you work in a male-dominated industry. What's that like?
It's a little bit challenge, but I think that we have to do our best. And after people say yes or no, so we are good or not, the important is make our best. After, I don't care about what they say.
Here in Venice, there are more than 400 licensed gondolas. They need replacing when they get bashed about in the canals. So will the gondolieres, who are almost entirely male, accept female-built gondolas? I'm going to take a ride to find out. Here we go. Let's sit here in this sort of king's chair.
Hello! I love you! Vado!
The gondolieri taking me through the canals of Venice is called Alessandro. He's been working on these canals for more than 30 years. What does he make of the Tramontine sisters?
Ma non è un problema di due donne, perché è solo un problema.
It's not about them being women. It's just a difficult job. If you've learned to do that job since you were born, maybe. But if the girls don't know the basics, how will they do it? I had never seen them work there. I don't know if they know as much as their father did. If they do, good luck to them.
Se ce l'hanno, tanto di cappello.
Finished.
I love you.
The gondola ride is over. The very small focus group shows perhaps that the Tramontane sisters still need to persuade some of their potential clients that they are to be trusted with this city's most famous tradition.
The BBC's James Reynolds reporting in Venice. You're tuned to the world.
Hi, I want to tell you about a new PRX podcast called Things That Go Boom. It's all about foreign policy, but not in the way you might think. At Things That Go Boom, they tell stories about our lives and the world around us in an effort to better understand the ins, outs, and what have yous of what keeps us safe. On the new season, they tell the story of the secret back-channel meetings, political ploys, and even broken bones that led to the Iran nuclear deal. And since President Trump yanked us out of that deal, they ask, are we headed for nuclear war? Things That Go Boom's second season, called Fallout, is available now. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. In North Korea, one of state TV's popular cartoons is about a group of cute bunnies who fight off an invading wolf. Is this some kind of metaphor?
You shouldn't assume everything is about politics in North Korea. Rabbits are occasionally just rabbits.
Yeah, but it's North Korea. That story, ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Back to our top story of the day, the escalating tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Earlier today, President Trump took to Twitter. He confirmed that last night he stopped a planned airstrike on Iran minutes before it was supposed to take place. And he did it, he wrote, because he was told 150 people would die. So how's Iran reacting to President Trump's move? For that, we turn to Ali Vaez. He directs the Iran Project at the International Crisis Group.
I think the problem is that the Iranians might have interpreted this as a sign of weakness and maybe extreme aversion within this administration, or at least on the part of the president, to enter into a military confrontation with them. And so they might decide to push further.
But even if Iran interprets it that way, what can they do? I mean, they're kind of stuck.
Look, the Iranians waited for about a year since President Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal in May of 2018 in the hope that the remaining parties to the nuclear agreement, the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese, would help them withstand the pressure of U.S. sanctions. This didn't happen, so now they're starting to lash out and they're starting to push back. I'm afraid when there's so much tension in so many flashpoints across the region, and no channel of communication and almost no exit ramp, that a single miscalculation could result in a regional conflagration.
Your group, the International Crisis Group, its mission is to de-escalate conflicts. And you've said the maximum pressure campaign leaves Iran with only military options, like taking down a U.S. drone. So now what? I mean, what do both sides need to do to get this back in the bottle?
I think in the recent escalation, there might be an opportunity for stepping back from the brink. And the way this could be done is that the Iranians have now demonstrated to the U.S. that there could be a cost associated with U.S.'s maximum pressure policy. And if the president is willing to reduce the pressure of sanctions and provide the Iranians with a reprieve, I think it is possible that we would see some U.S.-Iran engagement, maybe through a mediator, that would help de-escalate tensions and eventually move the parties towards achieving a broader and better agreement.
I mean, who would be a good mediator? There are no diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Iran. Oman's been mentioned. What other international actors can help get Iran and the U.S. off this collision course?
the profile of a mediator is someone who would be able to actually directly talk to President Trump, because almost no one in the president's entourage shares the interest in getting a mutually beneficial agreement with the Iranians. So the interlocutor would have to be someone with the profile of Prime Minister Abe of Japan or President Macron of France or President Putin of Russia, who can actually reach to both sides and talk directly with President Trump.
Shinzo Abe tried and kind of failed, and the same thing is with Macron. I mean, is there any daylight between these two countries that would enable any intermediary, however mutually respected, to do much?
Look, I think President Trump is learning how to negotiate with the Iranians, and there are two requirements there. I think one is for the Iranians to make sure that President Trump is not seeking regime change, which is what Prime Minister Abe suggested to President Trump, and he announced it publicly that he's not seeking regime change, in contrast to his close advisors who've been proponents of regime change in Iran for many years. And the second requirement is for the president to remove the gun from Iran's head and then ask for direct negotiations. I think the reason Prime Minister Abe's effort at trying to mediate between Iran and the U.S. failed is because the Trump administration sabotaged his mission, because just a few days before his trip to Tehran, it imposed a new set of sanctions targeting Iran's petrochemical industries. That's not the right way of talking to the Iranians. It would require the president to provide them with some sort of sanctions relief as a goodwill gesture.
Who in the Iranian regime does the U.S. negotiate with? Explain the division of opinion among the Iran leadership.
Look, the Iranians obviously have a complicated political structure, and there are many power centers. The problem is with the demise of the 2015 nuclear deal, there is now widespread skepticism about the utility of negotiating with the United States. So it's no longer really a division between the government of President Rouhani and his foreign minister, Javad Zarif, and the more hardline elements like the Revolutionary Guards or the Supreme Leader, who are much more skeptical of negotiating with the U.S. Now, the Iranians are quite skeptical about negotiating with President Trump for several reasons. One is that the North Koreans tell the Iranians that every time you come to an agreement with President Trump, he will turn around and Bolton and Pompeo would shred that agreement apart. Second, the president just had a deal with Mexico and Canada renegotiating NAFTA. And then he turned around and moved the goalposts and threatened Mexico with tariffs in order to extract more concessions from them. And remember that this is also the president who violated the 2015 nuclear deal and walked away from it. So I don't think the Iranians believe that they would be able to reach an agreement with President Trump, but some sort of summitry that would result in de-escalation of tensions and would provide them with some sort of reprieve, I think, is something that the leadership as a whole in Iran might welcome. But the circumstances for that would have to be right.
Ali Vaez is the director of the Iran Project at the International Crisis Group. Thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Another country the U.S. isn't exactly friends with is Russia. But the U.S. isn't alone. Some of Russia's neighbors in the old Soviet Union don't get along with Moscow either. Ukraine, for one, Moldova, too, and the Republic of Georgia. You may remember, Georgia actually fought a short war with Russia 11 years ago. Okay, so with all this in mind, imagine a Russian politician invited to speak to the Georgian parliament. He sits in the chair reserved for the speaker of the Georgian parliament. He addresses the assembly in the Russian language, not in Georgian. Moments later, a woman wrapped in a Georgian flag with camera crews trailing behind her storms in and calls for the Russian politician's removal. This happened last night. Georgians responded swiftly. Thousands of people attempted to force their way inside the parliament building.
The protesters are incredibly angry with the government for allowing an MP from the Russian Duma to come to Georgia, and this is someone who has had anti-Georgian stance for a long time, to come here, not only to come here, but to sit. And this is where it gets quite symbolic, to sit in a chair that has played a very important role in the establishment of Georgia's independence.
Natalia Antalava is with Coda Story in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi.
Police fired tear gas, and it was a lot of tear gas. I was there. The scenes were very chaotic. A lot of people got hurt. Two people lost their eyes.
Oh,
so today Georgians are back in front of parliament with banners, some of which you can make us blind, but we'll still see the truth.
How did these people lose their eyes? Was it a result of, was it a weapon or was it a reaction to something? What happened?
It was the rubber bullets. It was the rubber bullets.
These protests aren't really a message directed at Russia. Natalia says they're targeting Georgia's own government.
You cannot be a politician in Georgia and be pro-Russian. This is still an incredibly, fiercely pro-Western country where, the concepts like NATO and the EU are way more popular here than they are in the West itself. So you can't be pro-Russian and be in politics here.
There's been another casualty of Georgia's political crisis. The country's first ever gay pride parade was supposed to take place this weekend, but it's been postponed. Organizers say that's another victory for Vladimir Putin's Russia, which opposes gay rights. Reporter Natalia Antalava says postponement of the parade wasn't the intention of the protesters. She says Georgians, like the protesters in other former Soviet states, are sick of Russia meddling in their country's affairs.
The Georgians are definitely drawing inspiration from the Moldovans, from the Ukrainians, are saying that they're just fed up with the way that things run.
One last note, Russia announced today that it will soon suspend passenger flights to Georgia. Turkey did something this week that it hadn't done for 16 years. It held a televised and moderated political debate. The two candidates aren't running for president. They're vying to become the mayor of Turkey's largest city, Istanbul. This election on Sunday is really a do-over because the ruling party canceled the results of the first one in March. And as Duri Buskaran explains, many in Istanbul see this new vote as a make-or-break moment for Turkish democracy.
It was dark by the time Tolga Çetinkaya joined his friends to watch a live stream of the debate. At this park in Kadıköy, one of Istanbul's more secular neighborhoods, most people are fans of the opposition candidate, Ekrem İmamoğlu. He won the first election by about 13,000 votes. Çetinkaya says he thinks the ruling AK party stole the election from İmamoğlu.
They stole, steal, understand? He is actually our mayor.
With dark hair and glasses, 49-year-old İmamoğlu comes off as young and a bit nerdy as he makes the case for why the original election results should be honored. His opponent is Binali Yildirim with the AKP. Yildirim is a veteran of Turkish politics with a graying mustache. The TV debate stays cordial, but viewers in the park are not satisfied.
They're not right. I think the people will see. The people will see this, I think.
For the past 17 years, Turkey has been led by the AKP, a pro-business, moderately Islamist party. A surging economy fueled their popularity. It allowed leaders like President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to expand his control over the government, the judiciary, and the media. But this past March, amid growing concerns over a stumbling economy, Turkish voters elected opposition candidates to lead the country's largest cities, chief among them Istanbul, where Erdogan was once mayor. Economist Can Selçuk of the think tank İDEM says many AKP supporters in Istanbul have grown disillusioned with the party.
The main reason why people didn't turn out was A, economics, unemployment and inflation and, the depreciation of lira.
The AKP didn't accept the loss. They appealed to Turkey's election board and persuaded a panel of judges to throw out the results and schedule a do-over. Now the decision goes back to the voters. İmamoğlu is a relative newcomer to Turkish politics, but in his last post, he served as the local leader of a politically diverse suburb of Istanbul called Beylikdüzü. In a way, Beylikdüzü represents what's happening in Turkey, migration to cities from the rural heartland, and the upward mobility of more conservative Turks, who were often sidelined under previous governments. When you arrive, Beylikdüzü is marked by tall, high-end apartment buildings and shady, leafy parks. Taking a break on a park bench, Shema Gulteken says she moved here with her parents and brother 20 years ago, when Istanbul's population was about half of what it is today.
Here was like a farm. There weren't any cars, minibus.
Now she's 31, a landscape architect and university graduate. Gültekin says İmamoğlu has done some things for Beylikdüzü in the past few years, but the party that built the infrastructure and grew this sleepy little district into a high-end suburb, that was the AKP, and that's who she'll vote for.
We vote Binali Yıldırım. We forever Binali Yıldırım.
Every Sunday, Beylikdüzü hosts a market. A sea of shoppers wind their way among vegetable sellers, coolers full of cheese and yogurt. T-shirts, bras, and running shoes hang from the ceiling. Fatma Guruk sells white and brown eggs from her chickens in a village nearby. And she calls customers kızım, my girl. But when you ask her about politics, she gets serious. The economy is broken, she says. Everything here is expensive, and nobody has money anymore. She's 70, and she still has to sell eggs every week to pay her bills. İmamoğlu gives her and other Istanbul voters hope that things could change. Her şey çok güzel olacak, his campaign posters say. Everything is going to be just fine. Voters in Istanbul return to the polls on Sunday, and the whole country will be watching closely. For The World, Duri Buscarin, Istanbul.
The Canadian invasion of American basketball has entered a new phase. First, the Toronto Raptors win the NBA championship. Now, Canada's dominating the NBA draft. Six, count 'em, six Canadians have just been drafted by NBA teams. That's a record for any non-U.S. country. But the draft wasn't just about Canada.
The Detroit Pistons select Sekou Doumbouya from Orléans, France. The Indiana Pacers select Goga Bitadze from Tbilisi, Georgia. The San Antonio Spurs select Luka Samanić from Zagreb, Croatia.
Overall, 16 international players were selected by NBA teams, which made last night's broadcast a big event in several countries. Here's Goga Bitadze, who, as you heard, was just drafted by the Indiana Pacers.
This is for my family, definitely back in Georgia right now. They're watching. This is for them.
And some of the international players, including Bitadze, were asked to share their thoughts in their mother tongues.
Could you just repeat how you felt, but in Georgian, please?
Ah, okay. Zalijan karga tu gzeni tau im don čemi osne
by. Ma nevjerojatno, nisam imao riječi, jednostavno.
In France, you say?
So it's pretty clear the NBA is pushing hard to expand internationally with new audiences and new players. As of now, about one-fourth of the players in the league are foreign-born. A lot of fanfare this week in North Korea in honor of Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit. It was a propaganda coup for North Korea's Kim Jong-un, too. After all, this was the first time a Chinese leader visited Pyongyang in 14 years. In North Korea, propaganda can come in many forms: marching songs, billboards, and apparently stop-action animation. North Korean TV has been airing a kids' show that pits fluffy bunnies against an evil wolf that invades their territory. Which makes the world's Patrick Nguyen wonder, who's the wolf here? And what's the message?
The screams of a dastardly wolf. Shot with an artillery cannon. That's what he gets for invading the territory of our heroes, plump little bunnies with perky ears and round, innocent eyes. But make no mistake, violate their homeland and you will suffer.
Yes!
They will dump rocks on your head. And they will laugh and sing as you scream. In this scene, that arch-villain wolf has been forced into a hole by the bunnies. And they are stoning him to death. The bunnies are brutal, but brutal in a Tom and Jerry way. The bunnies are proud, clever, comrades till the end. The wolf is like Wile E. Coyote. He gets killed over and over. But never really dies. Always coming back to scheme and plot, though the bunnies are steadfast in their resistance. We don't know too much about bunny brothers and the wolf. Our colleagues at BBC Monitoring, they analyze media around the world, they saw it airing recently on North Korean state TV. and they say it would have been cleared by the propaganda department, currently directed by Kim Yo-jong, the younger sister of Kim Jong-un. I doubt she had anything to do with these bunnies because she got the job kind of recently, and this animation looks dated. You know the old Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer from the 1960s?
What's so funny about the way I talk?
It looks like that. But North Korea is very proud of the animation studio that appears to have produced Bunny Brothers. It gets praised on TV. Kim Jong-un himself recently stopped by to congratulate its workers. And they make a lot of kids' shows, like this cartoon, Squirrel and Hedgehog. It's about peace-loving squirrels and hedgehogs who are invaded by, that's right, evil wolves. Wolves with military uniforms and machine guns. So, what is the deal with all of these wolves? To figure this out, I called someone in North Korea, an Australian, Alec Sigley. He runs a tour company there called Tongil Tours, but he's also at a university in Pyongyang, studying North Korean literary themes. He says there's a word you should know, Sunyangi, which means wolves.
Sunyangi is often used to refer to the American army, Sunyangi Mije Nom, the wolf-like American imperialist bastards.
The wolf is sometimes used to represent Japanese soldiers, he says, but more often, Americans.
The cultural stereotype of bloodthirsty outside invaders is one that is quite strong, and it certainly has at least some historical basis.
Historical basis in the Korean War, when America, quote, burned down just about every city in North and South Korea both. That's from Curtis LeMay, the U.S. general in charge of the bombing. It was awful. And it laid down the granddaddy of all narratives in North Korea. Evil foreign powers will try and try, but they will always be repelled by the scrappy underdogs. Or, in this case, bunnies. So that settles it. The bunnies are North Korea. America is the treacherous wolf. Mystery solved. Right?
You shouldn't assume everything is about politics in North Korea. Rabbits are occasionally just rabbits.
Fyodor Tertitsky is an analyst with the outlet NK News. He can speak Korean in the northern dialect. I sent him some short clips of the Bunny Brothers, and he's not convinced it has any hidden message.
North Korea is usually not very subtle. They would just say that the evil American bastards must die.
So am I doing the American thing where I think everything in the world is really about us? Fyodor has me wondering. He says it's like a Russian watching Star Wars and thinking, ah, Luke Skywalker is actually the CIA, and Emperor Palpatine is actually the General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party.
Because, like, it's an American film, it was made during the Cold War. Well, of course it should be about Americans fighting the Soviets, because what else can it be?
So mystery unsolved, I guess? Maybe the wolf is just a wolf. Maybe North Koreans, Americans, everyone, we just like Tom and Jerry-style violence. Simple as that. Because actually, there's another cartoon that was once a big hit in North Korea about a tiny underdog outsmarting a giant tormentor. That show? Yep, it's Tom and Jerry. Only in Pyongyang, they call it the magic world of a mouse in the north. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Want to see those plucky rabbits trample the big bad wolf? We've got them at theworld.org. Finally, it's here, the first day of summer. Personally, I can't wait for sunnier skies here in Boston. We've been having a lot of rain. Anyway, if you're someone who likes to pull together a summer music playlist, then here's something to add to your list. It's No Sé from Mexico's Jimena Sariñana. Siento que Estás alejando. No Se is off Sariñana's latest album, Donde Bailarán Las Niñas, or Where Will the Girls Dance? It's her first album in 5 years and the first since she became a mom. Female empowerment, the freedom to express yourself, those are the big themes off the album. And Jimena should know. She's been in the public eye in Mexico since she was a kid, working as a child actor. She broke into the music business 11 years ago. Some in the indie pop music scene dismissed her, but she proved them wrong. Jimena Sariñana can write bright, poppy tunes like the best of them. We'll leave you with more No Sé as we head into the weekend. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back on Monday. No sé lo que pueda pasar si te acercas un poquito más. No sé, no sé lo que pueda pasar. Siempre le temes a lo mismo. Es tiempo que ya aceptes tu destino. Aceptes tu destino. Sabes, tú vienes conmigo. PRI, Public Radio International.